Well, I may be known to some of you, and I wish I were known to all of you, but that's impossible. And even if I were, I wouldn't be able to remember your names. However, I welcome you to this series of lectures by Professor Yuval Shani in memory of Sir Hersch Lajpat, who, as you probably realize, was my father. It's very good of Professor Shani to take the trouble to come and speak to us about a topic in which he's very expert and has written a great deal, namely the jurisdiction of international tribunals. And we look forward to hearing what he says. I welcome him here very warmly. Professor Shani is prominent among, certainly the most prominent amongst the younger Israeli scholars of international law. But despite his youth, he is a prolific author and teacher. He's written quite a number of books on the subject of jurisdiction and many, many articles in other people's collections of articles, as well as in legal periodicals. He is therefore formidable in his knowledge of the subject. We are very fortunate that he has been able to find time to come and visit us. He's had wide experience outside Israel. He's been a visitor at a number of universities in the United States and even in Australia. He's been at the Max Planck Institute. It's all rather remarkable as a series of accomplishments in the field. And in that respect, of course, he's following in the tradition very wisely and effectively set by the late Professor Rosen, whose production of material in international law continued virtually until the last days of his life. So, all that said, I warmly welcome Professor Shani and look forward to hearing what he has to say.
Thank you very much, Eli, for these very kind words, and I thank you very much for inviting me to come here. I feel honored and privileged to
have
be
so. Have you got your microphone on?
I have something which I think does enhance my voice. But give me a couple of minutes and I would be too loud to bear. So thank you very much for inviting me. It is a great honor and privilege. I'm particularly honored because I'm twice honored in the sense that I also occupy in Jerusalem the Hersch Lajpat Chair in international law, in public international law. And it is indeed a great privilege to hold the chair, and even a greater privilege now to come as the chairholder and speak at this Lajpat Memorial lecture series. So again, thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope to be worthy of this trust. To business then. We are going to discuss in today, tomorrow, and those who will survive on Thursday, jurisdiction and admissibility of cases before international courts. And what I'll try to investigate in this series of lecture is both the power that international courts are granted to exercise judicial power. So I will advocate a view which regards jurisdiction as a power to exercise power, and also the propriety of exercising such power. I will not address in this series of lectures some of the other uses of the term jurisdiction, which has been which can be found in the literature on international courts and tribunals, such as, for instance, the power to issue certain remedies, or the power to utilize certain ancillary powers and to issue interim decisions. The basic approach that I will be taking in this series of lectures is a functional approach, analyzing jurisdiction in light of the roles that international courts play in international life, and in light of the roles the jurisdictional rules and admissibility rules play in the lives of international courts. International courts and tribunals serve a variety of functions in international life. Their core judicial function involves dispute resolution, or more broadly, contribution to the solution and management of policy problems, interpretation of applicable law and its application to concrete situations, thereby strengthening the role of law and the rule of law in international relations. At a more general level, international courts can be understood as policy tools in the hands of two principal sets of constituencies: the mandate providers, which are the states and international organizations that establish international courts, fund international courts, support the operations of international courts, and may ultimately decide to shut down international courts. And the second constituencies are the parties to specific disputes that may seek to utilize international courts in order to address a specific dispute or policy problem that they are facing. From this instrumental perspective, one may view the establishment of courts, the conferral of jurisdiction upon them, and their actual activation in concrete cases as a means to an end, a way to advance the goals, the interests, values, and norms of members belonging to relevant legal communities or regime, as well as noted before, the specific parties to a dispute. The conferral ex ante of jurisdiction upon an international court thus reflects the choice of the mandate providers or potential parties to a future dispute to create conditions under which certain political, economic, social, and other interactions would take place in a more legalized environment where rights can be more readily enforced. And in the same vein, the activation of such jurisdictional basis in actual cases, either unilaterally or through agreement of the parties, reflects a choice by one or more of the parties to realize the possibility of upholding legal rights through adjudication. So the scope of jurisdiction of international courts, I would argue, correlates by and large to broadly held perceptions about the general utility of legal procedures, and their actual caseload is reflective of the prevalence of specific expectations that it would be useful to advance in concrete cases conflict resolutions or problem solution through judicial means. To be clear, the grant of jurisdiction to international courts, even in concrete cases, does not necessarily imply that judicial settlement should be or would be the only form of conflict or problem resolution. An agreement to refer a matter to an international court through an ad hoc compromis or ex ante jurisdictional provision found in a specific or general treaty merely implies a choice to add adjudication to the toolbox for handling policy problems at hand. Other political or diplomatic measures are still likely to be utilized before, after, and in parallel to adjudication. For example, when establishing the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia in Resolution 808 and 827, the Security Council also imposed a variety of sanctions on the former Yugoslavia, sent peacekeepers to the region, issued political condemnations, etc. So the ICTY served in this context as one policy tool in this particular mix of policies, beside other tools seeking to resolve the conflict or contain it or to restore law and order to the region. Still, once jurisdiction is established, even before it is activated in any concrete case, the shadow of litigation may affect the manner in which the other policies would be implemented, even if the solution of the problem at hand were eventually to be facilitated through non-judicial avenues. When a court's jurisdiction can be invoked, law typically becomes more conspicuous in political negotiations. Hence, perhaps the most dramatic effect of the dispute settlement procedures of the WTO after the 1995 conferral of compulsory jurisdiction on the dispute settlement panels and appellate body should be looked for not in the relatively small number of cases that were litigated before them, which in international law practice are actually considered quite a significant number of cases, but rather in the larger group of cases resolved without adjudication, either through consultation or even more importantly, in those cases where the dogs didn't bark, namely that their decisions to violate WTO law weren't taken by member states because of the shadow of international jurisdiction. In the same vein, the highest hopes that were cast for the International Criminal Court upon its establishment was that its jurisdiction would serve as deterrence for leaders and senior military personnel against committing international crimes, and that the court itself would be thus rarely utilized. In the colorful words of outgoing prosecutor Moreno Campo, in his swearing-in ceremony, the effectiveness of the International Criminal Court should not be measured by the number of cases they reach it. On the contrary, complementarity implies that the absence of trials before this court as a consequence of the regular functioning of national institutions would be a major success. So no cases is good, except for budgetary aspects. But why are mandate providers and disputing parties choosing to confer jurisdiction upon international courts as opposed to other third-party decision-making procedures, such as mediation or conciliation? One possible reason is the attraction found in channeling dispute resolution to law-based avenues. The law offers the parties to a transaction and other relevant constituencies a degree of stability and predictability. It also conveys notions of fairness and equal treatment. In many areas, the law also offers a robust method to ensure the prioritization of certain values of interest, and moving disputes from the rather anarchic world of politics to a more organized world of legal categories also helps international actors to compartmentalize certain sets of issues and to remove them from the political decision makers to professional lawyers. This depoliticization of certain relations and conflict has been regarded as one of the greatest achievements of contemporary international law, especially in the field of economic relations. Still, there are some special reasons why mandate providers and disputing parties confer jurisdiction upon international courts as tools for addressing a specific policy problem or as a standing solution for a category of recurring policy problems. Most significantly, international courts enjoy considerable social legitimacy in the eyes of relevant audiences. Their structures and procedures are generally viewed as fair. The disputing parties have a right to present their views before the court. The court comprises of independent and impartial judges, and pre-existing legal rules constrain the procedures and the outcome without appearing to prefer a priori any one of the parties. Furthermore, the judicial process at both the national and international level is perceived as entailing a professional and faithful application of the law to facts. To the extent that the law is perceived to mirror justice or social preferences, or other values, a judicial process advancing such law application would be regarded by relevant constituencies morally and socially desirable. Using Thomas Frank's vocabulary on legitimacy, one may identify in the structures, procedures, and outcome of international courts all four of his legitimacy-enhancing features. Courts help in elucidating and concretizing law, thus coloring international law application in more determinate and justified colors, setting the stage for legitimizing additional instances of law application. They draw upon the reputation of local courts as symbols of procedural fairness and substantive justice, and often emphasize in their title their own justice pedigree as a form of symbolic validation, such as, for instance, the case of the International Court of Justice. They are committed to consistent law interpretation and uniform law application, thus invoking the legitimating power of coherence, and they adhere in their work to the principle of legality as well to other basic legal principles. In sum, the acoustic separation between law and politics, facilitated by the delegation of jurisdiction to international courts, hence the removal of judicial decision making from day-to-day power politics to the realm of principal decision making on the basis of legal considerations, is a legitimating asset which renders judicial intervention in policy problems a more acceptable form of intervention in the eyes of important constituency than other policy alternatives. Again, this does not mean that the establishment of international jurisdiction renders other alternatives unacceptable or less acceptable than before. In fact, the opposite may be true. For example, the referral of the Libya situation to the International Criminal Court may have conferred considerable legitimacy on the sanctions then imposed by the Security Council of Libya, as well as NATO's military intervention in the civil war. At the same time, conferring jurisdiction on an international court often entails some loss of flexibility for all involved parties and may constrain the policy options available to the relevant mandate providers and disputing parties. Hence, there are also, beside the legitimacy benefits, there are also policy costs associated with this authorization. First, the decision to resolve a political problem through legal methods, directly or indirectly, namely through adjudication or via the shadow of adjudication, often entails a narrowing of the possible outcomes. Courts do not engage in package deals, nor can they always adopt splitting of the difference type of solutions. And once jurisdiction permitting the enforcement of legal rights has been established, the scope of politically acceptable solution may be altered, so that politicians, for instance, may be expected in such cases to stand on their rights more resolutely. Second, and related, international courts tend, once activated, to frame issues in ways that constrain non-judicial policy options. For instance, again, using the Libya example, once the ICC issued arrest warrants against Muammar Gaddafi for his suspected involvement in crimes against humanity, the settlement of the Libyan civil war without Gaddafi's prosecution has become a much less plausible policy alternative. Third, the possibility of judicial involvement necessarily implies a certain loss of control by politicians over the resolution of the policy problem. Hence, it effectuates change in the balance of power among decision makers. Finally, the actual submission of the problem to an international court, may reduce the motivation of the parties to the dispute and third parties to engage in diplomatic negotiations, potentially that could potentially lead to a political settlement. So the first segment of this presentation discussed the choice, the implications of the choice to create a court, invest it with jurisdiction, and to activate the jurisdiction in specific cases. So the establishment of jurisdiction and its actual invocation opens up some policy options for international actors and closes or changes other policy options. But what is the function of jurisdiction in the lives of international courts, and how does it relate to their legitimacy and effectiveness? The conferment of jurisdiction on international courts involves, as just noted, two expressions of will or intent denoting two separate transfers of power. These two expressions have already been alluded to by Judge Daxner in his dissent in Corfu Channel. And I quote, the word jurisdiction has two fundamental meanings in international law. The word is used to recognize the court as an organ instituted for the purpose jus dicere, and in order to acquire the ability to appear before it. Two, to determine the competence of a court, i.e. to invest the court with the right to solve concrete cases. The general or foundational authority of the court is established as a rule through a multilateral agreement, typically a constitutive treaty, establishing the court and delineating the outer boundaries of its jurisdictional powers: personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, temporal jurisdiction, etc. And setting out the conditions that create the overall legal framework which regulates the exercise of jurisdiction in concrete cases, namely consent by the disputing parties to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, exhaustion of alternative remedies, etc. A critical decision that the mandate providers must reach in this regard is whether to constitute the international court jurisdiction as compulsory or voluntary in nature, that is, whether or not to require consent of both parties for each specific exercise of jurisdiction. Secondly, for any specific case to be brought before the court, one or more of the parties must intend to utilize the said framework that was created by the mandate providers. Where the constitutive instrument provides for the actual exercise of jurisdiction, that the actual exercise of jurisdiction by the court is subject to an additional consent requirement, joint intent must be found in the form of an explicit agreement, a compromis, or an implicit meeting of the minds through forum prorogatum. Note, however, that the two manifestations of intent by the mandate providers and parties are logically subject to a specific sequencing order. The general authority of the court predates and constrains the specific authorization that the parties can bestow upon it. In the words of the ICJ in the Bosnian Genocide case, 207, questions of access to the court, which are essentially, in my terminology, questions of foundational jurisdiction, may be regarded as an issue prior to that of jurisdiction ratione personae. Still, even if a given court's jurisdiction is voluntary, individual actors may commit in advance to provide consent to applications brought against them, either through accepting a compromissory clause governing future disputes or signing on to a general jurisdictional instrument such as the General Act of 28 or declarations under the optional clause of the ICJ statute. It could have been argued that such undertakings to accept future jurisdiction ought to be regarded as unilateral stipulations transforming the court's jurisdictional structure, at least with regard to certain interactions between certain potential parties, from voluntary to compulsory. A better way, I think, to understand such undertakings is to maintain that they do not change the consensual nature of adjudication in those cases when the mandate providers have so decreed, but rather constitute a manifestation of such a requirement. The constitutive instruments can be understood in this context to grant all member states the right to refuse consent to adjudication. And like many other rights, such a right is subject to a full or partial waiver in the form of an ex ante commitment, in our case, in the form of ex ante commitment to adjudicate. Indeed, as we shall see below, specific instruments of consent cannot add new powers to the court, that is, confer upon it more jurisdiction that was delegated to it by its mandate providers. The effect of these jurisdiction-creating and conferring instruments on international court should be understood through reference to two related concepts, delegation and consent, essential to establishing the legality and legitimacy of international adjudication. Delegation is a key concept in understanding the powers of all international organizations. Unlike states that have under the Lotus Principle all the powers that they have not surrendered through a binding international law obligation, international governmental organizations, and courts, for that matter as well, only have the powers delegated to them explicitly and implicitly by states. Some of the latter implicit powers are sometimes classified as inherent powers. Clearly, states and international governmental organizations cannot pass on more powers to other international governmental organizations than they cumulatively have. In the same ways, IGOs cannot delegate more power to subsidiary bodies or other bodies they establish than they have. In essence, when a jurisdiction is created, what is being conferred by states is a decision-making power, either political or judicial in nature, to undertake obligations, to construe one's obligations, to enforce one's obligations, to take or refrain from taking measures, etc. Such power can be delegated unconditionally, but, as typically is the case, is subject to certain conditions and constraints concerning the manner of application of such powers that were conferred. Now, I should say that I'm using the term delegation here rather loosely as noting transfer of power. I'm not going to discuss questions relating to the revocability of delegation or questions relating to whether courts should be construed as agents or trustees. These are interesting questions, but we do not have the time to cover them here. When I speak about delegation, what I intend to convey, the meaning I intend to convey is a transfer of power. Now, the question of permissibility of delegation of judicial authority to a court from a political body has arisen in a number of occasions as a preliminary challenge to the jurisdiction of specific courts in specific cases. For instance, in the 1954 advisory opinion on the effects of awards of compensation made by the United Nations Administrative Tribunal, the International Court of Justice held that the General Assembly had an implicit power to establish a tribunal as part of its constitutional power to regulate the activities of another organ, that is the Secretariat. And I quote, "The power to establish a tribunal to do justice between the organization and the staff members was essential to ensure the efficient working of the Secretariat and to give effect to the paramount consideration of securing the highest standards of efficiency, competence, and integrity. Capacity to do this arises by necessary entendment out of the charter." So this is the notion of implicit authority to create subsidiary bodies and confer upon them, in this context, judicial power. Similarly, in Tadic, the ICTY has held that the power to create a criminal court was an exercise of one of the council legal powers under the charter, that is to regulate a situation compromising international peace and security. But these cases are not really about the exercise of jurisdiction by international courts. They are rather about the exercise of jurisdiction by IGOs, which may affect, in turn, the lawfulness of creating a court to begin with. For most international courts, there is little, if any, doubt that under international law, states were entitled to decide to create them and to delegate to them some of their general powers to resolve disputes and to instruct them upon delegation to apply a judicial method for the resolution of these disputes. Hence, the creation of courts is a manifestation of the right to sovereignty, in the words used by Baron Deschamps in his 1899 report submitted to the Hague Convention. Adjudication is an enlightened exercise of sovereignty. In addition, states may delegate certain powers to IGOs and at the same time impose a condition that international judicial or quasi-judicial bodies would monitor the exercise of certain powers. We've already seen that this may reflect the raison d'etre for establishing the UN Administrative Tribunal. It may also explain the creation, the structure through which ICLOS Seabed Dispute Chamber has been created, or the World Bank Inspection Panel. They all exemplify a combination of empowerment on the one hand, coupled with the introduction of institutional safeguards against abuse of power as a sort of implicit authority deriving from the original empowerment. Finally, states can delegate powers typically held by national courts to functionally equivalent international courts, and indeed a number of international courts have been invested with jurisdictional powers that mirror the powers of national courts. These may include the power of the ICC to exercise jurisdiction instead of the territorial state or the state of nationality of the accused, the power of NAFTA Chapter 19 panels to exercise jurisdiction over challenges to agency determinations of anti-dumping and countervailing duties instead of local administrative courts, and the potential power of ICSID tribunals to substitute the national courts of the host states in which investments take place. While delegation delineates the general authority of international courts, consent typically establishes their power to address a specific dispute, operating not only as a legal condition imposed by the mandate providers, like other conditions, such as temporal or geographical limits on the exercise of jurisdiction, but also as an important factor legitimating the operation of international courts, ensuring in Franckian terms the adherence of international adjudication with one, if not the most basic principle, of the international legal system in an age of voluntarism. Again, quoting from the PCAJ, this time in the Eastern Karelia case, the rule of consent, moreover, only accepts and applies a principle which is a fundamental principle of international law, namely the principle of independence of states. It is well established in international law that no state can, without its consent, be compelled to submit its dispute with other states, either to mediation or to arbitration, or to any kind of pacific settlement. Indeed, when state consent is lacking, the exercise of jurisdiction by a court may be subject to serious legitimacy challenges. This is, for instance, the case with the exercise, characterizing the exercise of criminal jurisdiction over individuals against the opposition of their state of nationality, where courts, although legally authorized to exercise such jurisdiction, ran into legitimacy challenge because of the structural tension between criminal justice and state consent as the basis of adjudication. Examples being the hostile attitude of Serbia to the ICTY and of Sudan to the ICC. Another example of such tensions between the exercise of jurisdiction and the principle of consent would occur where the court assumes jurisdiction over the objections of a relevant state in circumstances where it is far from clear whether consent was properly given at any point in time. This may be the Nicaragua case, maybe illustrative of this category of cases, or where the interpretation of the consent granting instrument appears to be somewhat strained, as in the case of Bosnia versus Serbia. In Franckian terms, one may state that the application of the consent principle, application, sorry, of the consent principle, which are indeterminate or incoherent, may suffer themselves from under legitimacy and generate a limited compliance pool. One may also note in this context Fitzmaurice's remark that all cases where jurisdictional challenges are raised reveal less than full consent to the court's jurisdiction. It thus appears that awareness to this tension and to the need to avoid serious legitimacy challenge has led the International Court of Justice to adopt in a series of cases a high threshold for expressions of consent. For instance, in the agency case, and also in the mutual assistance in criminal matters case, the court held that the consent of parties to its jurisdiction must be certain, unequivocal, voluntary, and indisputable. The same notion and the same legitimacy concerns may also explain the refusal of the International Court of Justice to narrowly construe reservations to optional clause declarations in cases such as fisheries jurisdiction. So, jurisdiction reflects the sum of powers allocated to international courts. It also signifies the limits imposed on those powers. Personal jurisdiction limits the identity of the natural or legal persons subject to the court's authority. Subject matter jurisdiction limits the scope of topics, which can be reviewed by the relevant judicial body, etc., etc. In addition, numerous additional conditions attendant to the grant of jurisdiction, such as consent, exhaustion of remedies, lack of alternative forum, etc., further constrain the powers of courts. Such conditions may originate in the constitutive instruments of the court, that is, attached to the foundational authorization granted to the court by its mandate providers, or derived from other sources. For example, they may derive from general international law, to the extent that the constitutive instrument did not stipulate upon them. For instance, in the ELSI case, the ICJ held that the condition of exhaustion of local remedies applies to investment claims, even if it was not stipulated in the specific jurisdiction conferring instrument, An additional source for constraining conditions may be found in the instrument conveying the consent of the parties, that is, attaching to the specific authorization granted to the court. The constraining aspect of jurisdiction was acknowledged by the International Court of Justice in its 2006 decision in armed activities on the territory of Congo, DRC versus Rwanda, where the court held that the court's jurisdiction is based on the consent of the parties and is confined to the extent accepted by them. When the consent is expressed in a compromissory clause in an international agreement, any condition to which such consent is subject must be regarded as constituting the limits thereon. And indeed, pursuant to this approach, the ICJ held in mutual assistance that as a result, questions relating to such conditions appertaining to the original conferment of jurisdiction are questions of jurisdiction and not question of admissibility, an issue I will elaborate upon further on. Still, I would qualify this assertion and note that some conditions appearing in the constitutive instruments and other sources for the establishment of jurisdiction are more rigid than others. Some deprive the relevant international courts of power to decide certain issues, at least in a certain point in time, for instance, until remedies have been properly exhausted. However, other conditions afford the court discretion in deciding whether or not to exercise the jurisdictional power that was granted to it, and I will classify subsequently, I will propose that these subsequent provisions which grant the court discretion, with discretion, as pertaining to questions not of jurisdiction, but rather of admissibility. In any event, however, there are limits to the ability of party consent to impose conditions that affect the foundational powers of the court. The imposition of such limits may be justified not only in technical terms of legal incompatibility, namely that the power to attach conditions to a consent-granting statement is itself limited explicitly or implicitly by the instrument establishing the court and facilitating the conferment of specific authorization via consent. It can also be defended by way of allusion to consideration of effectiveness and legitimacy. Thus, in NATO use of force, the 2004 case, the ICJ justified its controversial conclusion pertaining to the narrow construction of Article 35(2) of the statute, regulating access to the court, or in my terminology, foundational personal jurisdiction, by states not parties to the statute, so as to exclude the possibility of reliance on post-1945 jurisdictional agreements in the following terms. The object and purpose of Article 35 of the statute is to define the conditions of access to the court. It would have been inconsistent with the main thrust of the text to make it possible in the future for states to obtain access to the court simply by the conclusion between themselves of a special treaty, multilateral or bilateral, containing a provision to that effect. So while the court's position that there exists a conflict between the two norms, the specific jurisdiction-creating instrument and the foundational jurisdiction provision may be questioned, as it doesn't seem that there is an obvious reason why the mandate providers would have wished to exclude the utilization of the court by non-member states meeting certain conditions, the principle expounded that the general powers of the court limit the space left for the parties to consent and stipulate on that consent is, in my mind, true. Another example of such a decision can be found in Judge Lauterbach's famous dissents in both the Norwegian loans case and the Inderhandel case, which stand for a similar proposition, namely that the party's consent to jurisdiction is limited by the court's own foundational jurisdiction. When confronted with the Connolly Amendment, which subjected U.S. consent to the ICJ's jurisdiction to a self-judging determination as to whether the dispute is of a domestic nature, Judge Lauterbach took the view that this conflicted with the authority of the court to be the ultimate arbiter of its jurisdiction pursuant to Article 36(6) of the statute, the competence de la competence provision. Such authority, which he regarded as an indispensable element of legal obligation and part of the constitutional makeup of the ICJ, could not be stipulated upon by the parties. In other words, it appears as if Lauterbach was concerned about the need to protect the legitimacy of the court and the rule of law it applies and reject the system of adjudication which will subject the core judicial function, that is the determination of the court's own authority, to an external political control. Hence, party may decide whether or not to grant power to the court, but they cannot condition, according to this line of argumentation, the grant of power by superimposing their decision-making power over that of the court. It's a point also elaborated upon by the Permanent Court of International Justice in the Free Zones case. In the same vein, one can understand the decision by the European Court of Human Rights in the famous Luizido case of 1995 on the validity of the Turkish reservation to its declaration accepting the jurisdiction of the court as concerned primarily with issues of effectiveness. As is well known, the European Court of Human Rights held that held in that case that a key condition appended to a declaration of consent to its jurisdiction, namely Turkey's limitation of the court's jurisdiction to the sovereign territory of Turkey, runs contrary to the object and purpose of the European Convention on Human Rights and would weaken the effectiveness of the convention system. And I quote, such a system, which would enable states to qualify their consent under the optional clauses, would not only seriously weaken the role of the Commission and the court, those were the days when we had a commission, in the discharge of their functions, but would also diminish the effectiveness of the convention as a constitutional instrument of European public order, in brackets, ordre public. Moreover, where the convention permits states to limit their acceptance under Article 25, there is an express stipulation to that effect. In the court's view, having regard to the object and purpose of the convention system as set out above, the consequences for the enforcement of the convention and the achievement of its aims would be so far-reaching that the power to this effect should have been expressly provided for. However, not such provision exists in either Article 25 or 46. So if indeed the court is and should be concerned about effectiveness, that is, goal attainment, then a teleological interpretation of the power to stipulate upon consent to jurisdiction in a way that minimizes legal black holes ought to be given precedence over the more conservative consent-based approach argued for by Turkey. Furthermore, there exists a critical difference between Luizido, the holding in Luizido, and the dissent by Lauterbach. Whereas for Judge Lauterbach, the outcome of the incompatibility of the reservation and the foundational jurisdiction of the court was that the reservation was invalid, but also that the declaration of acceptance was invalid, the court in Luisito severed the Turkish condition or reservation from the declaration expressing consent to its jurisdiction and retained jurisdiction over the merits of the case. This difference in approach implies perhaps two things. First, that the legitimizing role of consent may be greater for some courts than for others. Hence, it may be the case that courts operating within the context of a special regime or charged with the promotion of a special agenda, like trade or human rights, value the ability to uphold the substantive norms of the regime as more important for establishing their legitimacy in the eyes of relevant constituencies than the need to secure certain unequivocal, voluntary, and indisputable consent. Indeed, the movement towards conferring courts with compulsory jurisdiction, specialized courts with compulsory jurisdiction, either through amendment of their constitutive instruments or by the growing number of compromissory clauses and general undertakings effectively conferring upon them compulsory jurisdiction in an ever-increasing number of transactions, suggests that for states themselves, that states themselves value consent to adjudication less in some cases than the greater effectiveness which compulsory jurisdiction promises to bring about. The second point, the second difference between the two decisions, or the second explanation for the difference, is that there may be differences in political contexts that influence the willingness of states potentially subject to a court's foundational jurisdiction to grant or withhold consent. One possible for the ICJ's general reluctance to embrace a pro-consent interpretive presumption, that is to rule in cases in benefit of accept, to rule in borderline cases in favor of accepting jurisdiction, despite possible flaws in the consenting instruments, the reason why the ICJ has been reluctant to embrace such a position is may have been that such an approach may deter states from accepting the jurisdiction of the court over any transaction. If, for instance, reservations to optional clause declarations would be read too narrowly, or if compromissory clauses would be read too broadly, states would not deposit declarations and would not sign on compromissory clauses to begin with. At the same time, it may be speculated that for the European Court of Human Rights, by 1995, the date of the Luisito decision, the court felt sufficiently confident in its perceived legitimacy and assessed that the likelihood of a backlash, such as the withdrawal of declarations of acceptance of its jurisdiction, would be rather low in light of the wide support it enjoyed from a critical mass of countries in Europe. In any event, when we evaluate courts as policy tools and ask whether they are effective, we ought to consider not only issues of goal attainment, namely whether courts are realizing the expectations that led to their creation, typically improved enforcement of norms, resolution of disputes, better resolution of disputes, support of legal regimes, and the legitimization of norms and institutions, but we should also ask ourselves whether courts have been equipped with the necessary foundational and specific jurisdictional powers to attain their goals. We should also assess in this regard the impact of the conditions attended to jurisdictional power. Therefore, for instance, if the ICC has been created as a policy tool intended to end impunity, but has been equipped by limited personal jurisdiction, so that in the absence of a Security Council mandate, only individuals who allegedly perpetrated crimes in state that consented to the court jurisdiction or hold the nationality of such state can be tried, then in a world in which the Security Council rarely grants authorizations and states implicated in conflicts, certainly South Africa and perhaps Latin America, tend not to consent to the court jurisdiction, its ability to realize its policy goals may be quite limited. In the same vein, any expectation that the International Court of Justice would play a central role in the maintenance of international peace and security must be confronted with the strong consent element that underlies the exercise of ICJ jurisdiction and the propensity of states to reject binding third-party settlement in cases involving important national interests. Furthermore, the court can hardly be expected to address many contemporary issues and disputes when individual operators and even IGOs cannot access its settlement facilities. At the same time, it will be too limiting to regard jurisdictional powers as a fixed attribute that predetermines judicial performance. Acceptance of jurisdiction, of the jurisdiction of the court can often, though certainly not always, be regarded as a vote of confidence in the court and as a sign of satisfaction with the court's record of performance. Hence, the stable, though quite limited, flow of cases to the International Court of Justice, reflective of the limited propensity of states to consent to its jurisdiction, is also reflective perhaps of a continuous but limited appreciation of its utility. At the same time, the increase in the jurisdictional powers of the European Court of Human Rights during the 1990s, reflected by a growing member in the membership to the convention, improved access to individuals, removal of prior consent as a condition for adjudication, can be understood, at least partly, as a positive evaluation of its performance by the relevant constituency. In short, jurisdictional powers constrain a court's performance, but through a feedback loop, performance, or at least perceptions of performance, also constrain or expand actual jurisdictional powers. So if jurisdiction reflects power, in the present context, the capacity to adjudicate, then I would propose to treat issues of admissibility as pertaining to the conditions governing the propriety of the application of such power. In other words, international courts may be authorized not only to exercise judicial power, but also to decide whether to exercise such judicial power. The authorization to decide whether to exercise judicial power, that is, whether to find cases inadmissible, may be found explicitly in the constitutive instruments governing the court's jurisdiction, or derived implicitly therefrom, alongside the foundational grant of jurisdiction, or at least in theory, in the specific instruments representing the intent or consent of the parties to invoke the jurisdiction of the court in a given case. Again, it may also be found in ex ante instruments of authorization, such as compromissory clauses or optional clause declaration, replacing the need for an expression of ad hoc consent by one of the parties. For example, Article 53 of the ICC Statute, a constitutive instrument containing a general grant of authorization, instructs the court to review under certain circumstances a decision by the prosecutor not to proceed with a prosecution where such course of action would not be in the interest of justice. This amounts, in my mind, to an authorization of the court to decide whether or not to exercise the jurisdictional power invested in it under a certain set of circumstances. Another example, drawn from UNCLOS, from the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, an instrument establishing inter alia a new court, ICLOS, but also containing a compromissory clause referring cases to existing adjudicated to the various adjudicated procedures listed in UNCLOS, provides in Article 295, a court or tribunal provided for in Article 287, the cafeteria list, to which an application is made in respect of a dispute referred to in Article 297, shall determine at the request of the party, or may determine proprio motu, whether the claim constitutes an abuse of legal process, or whether prima facie it is well-founded. As we will discuss later on, both abuse of process and ill-founded nature of a claim can be understood as admissibility standards, as they seem to pertain not to the very, arguably, not to the very existence of judicial power, but to the propriety of exercising it in certain circumstances. Another possible source of admissibility standards may be found in general international law, norms governing the exercise of judicial power. Courts have often operated on the basis of the assumption that their constitutive instruments were not designed to exclude the application of these general principles. Thus, for instance, one can understand the ICJ's decision in Monetary Gold to decline to hear a case where the vital issue concerned the responsibility of a third party as an application, like with the example of Eastern Karelia, I will expand on momentarily, of the principle of consent as a limit on the exercise of judicial power. Another example can be found in the case of rights of minorities in Upper Silesia, where the court held its jurisdiction would become inoperative in those exceptional cases in which the dispute, which states may desire to refer to the court, would fall within the exclusive jurisdiction reserved to some other authority. Arguably, it is the principle of pacta sunt servanda here that the court upholds in accepting the possibility that in such circumstances it may decline jurisdiction. Still, the question of the relationship between the court's jurisdiction and general international law is hardly open and shut. And as we will see, not tonight, but tomorrow or on Thursday, a number of specific legal regimes have questioned their authority to decline jurisdiction on the basis of general international law in the absence of an explicit mandate to that effect. A number of courts and commentators have also asserted that courts enjoy an inherent power to decline to exercise jurisdiction in cases where to do so would undermine their judicial function, that is, legitimacy, or would be devoid of purpose, that is, lack of effectiveness. Arguably, the ICJ decision in Northern Cameroons, I'm quoting, that there are inherent limitations on the exercise of the judicial function, which the court, as a court of justice, can never ignore, supports this assertion. It is harder to find examples of an authorization to decide whether to exercise judicial power or not in instruments reflective consent to refer a specific dispute to an international court, since the act of specific consent already implies a belief that the case should be adjudicated. Still, in the same way that the court is not always bound by limitations imposed by conditions to consent, it is also not bound to hear a case if there are constitutional, namely foundational, or other overriding reasons for not doing so, as suggested by the Permanent Court of International Justice in the Free Zones case. Perhaps some practice illustrative of this idea that a court can refuse to decline jurisdiction even when the parties to the case requested to hear the case can also be derived from the ICJ jurisprudence in advisory opinions cases, where the court has repeatedly upheld its right to decline to hear cases, notwithstanding the wishes of the referring body, which would typically be the General Assembly, the Security Council, or another competent agency. As already noted, the scope of jurisdiction, the judicial power allocated to the court, may be correlated to its ability to attain its goals and to enjoy legitimacy in the eyes of relevant constituencies. Similarly, effectiveness and legitimacy considerations may justify a decision not to apply such powers. Hence, international courts may wish to avoid issuing decisions that would contribute little, if anything, to the resolution of the underlying dispute or problem facing them, but may adversely affect their legitimacy in the eyes of important constituencies. Discretionary rules on admissibility may provide the court with a legally valid methodology to circumvent undesirable exercises of power. Thus, for example, in Eastern Karelia, the only advisory opinion in which the Permanent Court of International Justice, or for that matter the International Court of Justice, has declined as a matter of discretion a request for an advisory opinion, the court cited considerations of effective and legitimacy in support of its decision. That is, lack of consent and lack of cooperation by a relevant state, in that case, Russia. Although state consent was not constitutionally needed in advisory opinion cases, the court felt in that case the general international law bars it in the ruling circumstances from hearing a case against a state that is not even a member of the League of Nations without that state's consent. Namely, it felt that the exercise of jurisdiction under the circumstances would conflict with a fundamental principle of international law, that is, consent. In addition, the court opined that it would be inexpedient to proceed without Russia's cooperation, since the court's ability to establish the facts at the basis of the dispute would be seriously compromised. The court was thus of the view that answering a legal question without a solid factual basis would be both illegitimate and ineffective. And I quote, the court, being a court of justice, cannot even in giving advisory opinions depart from the essential rules guiding their activity as a court. Similarly, in Northern Cameroons, the court decided not to exercise its jurisdiction over a dispute raising a question of an inoperative nature, holding that for the court to proceed further in the case would not, in its opinion, be a proper discharge of its duties. Arguably, the lack of purpose of the application not only amounted to a potential wasteful utilization of judicial resources, i.e. a question of effectiveness, it may have also painted the court in a negative light as a useless institution, thus compromising its legitimacy. This legitimacy concern may have given rise for a duty, and now I quote, a duty to safeguard the judicial process. In other words, protecting the court's judicial function required in the case, according to the majority's opinion, an abdication of jurisdiction. Other examples of a defensive use of admissibility tests can be found in the work of other international courts as well. For example, the European Court of Human Rights has found application raised in two politically sensitive cases involving multilateral efforts in the Balkans, Bankovic and Berami, inadmissible by reason of lack of a jurisdictional link between the alleged victims and the responding states. In both cases, it appears as if the use of the court's broad powers of discretion to preliminarily dismiss an application on what are essentially substantive grounds, no relevant legal obligation, were meant inter alia to diffuse a potential conflict between the court and a significant number of important member states involved in the multilateral operation in question, which was motivated to some extent by humanitarian concerns. While the court was criticized, rightfully in my view, for misusing its discretion in both cases, commentators, myself included, think that those cases were actually quite well-founded as a matter of law. Understanding these decisions as attempts to secure the effectiveness and legitimacy of the court, at least in the eyes of some constituencies, provides, to my mind, an important perspective for understanding this category of decisions. I think I will stop here.